I'll miss him, but it'll be still be good to have him on the committee to ask good questions.
Anchorage Republican John Cowdery resigns as chair of the Legislative Council. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 22nd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Trident's processing plant in Chignik burns to the ground.
The season won't last as long as it was intended because of the fire and the shutdown of the facility.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
Anchorage Republican Senator John Cowdery, under federal indictment on conspiracy and corruption charges, today resigned his powerful position as chairman of the Legislative Council. He retains his elected position as a member of the Senate majority. Juneau Democrat Kim Elton takes over the chair, and Cowdery retains his membership on the council. In a letter to Senate President Lyda Green, Cowdery said the job is time-intensive and cited health problems for keeping him from fulfilling the responsibilities it requires. Green accepted the resignation, saying Cowdery has run the council well for the past 2 years.
It's something he's very good at and overseeing as an old contractor. That helps when you're leading up Ledge Council and all the different building projects you have to oversee and to kind of keep a check on. So I'll miss him, but it'll still be good to have him on the committee to ask good questions.
The Legislative Council handles special needs as well as the routine operations of the legislature during the interims between sessions. It will head up the investigation into the circumstances surrounding the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan. Elton will take over that task. Late this afternoon, State House members introduced legislation that would help people in remote communities meet their ever-increasing electric costs. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
In her proclamation calling the current special legislative session, Governor Palin gave lawmakers the opportunity to consider statutory changes to the Power Cost Equalization Program, but she left it up to them to devise their own way of improving the program. The first draft of a Power Cost Equalization rewrite has not yet been scheduled for committee review. It increases the amount of electricity that can be used during the winter from 500 to 700 kilowatt hours per month. During the summer, the covered usage will reduce from 500 to 300 kilowatt hours. Utilities will be reimbursed for the difference between the average of urban rates and either $2 an hour or the actual power cost, whichever is lower. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska will determine those rates. The bill also removes a ban from the PCE program for communities that receive their electric service from hydroelectric facilities. Members quickly point out that changes to the bill are possible as it moves through the House and Senate. The Senate version of the bill will be introduced Thursday and will be referred directly to the Finance Committee, where it will join five other bills on its agenda for the special session. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A processing plant on the Alaska Peninsula was destroyed by fire yesterday afternoon. From KSDP in Sandpoint, Tony Gorman has more.
The village public safety officer and local residents responded to the call of a fire at the Trident Seafoods processing plant in Chignik around 2 p.m. Alaska State Trooper spokesperson Beth Ispin says they fought the blaze for 2 hours before backing off.
About an hour into fighting the fire efforts, they started smelling ammonia, and they grew concerned, but they continued to fight for another hour when it just became the point where they were really concerned about everybody's safety. So they backed off, they cleared the area, they evacuated people from a half mile radius around the plant. About 250 to 300 workers there at the plant were moved to another area, a support area, where they're being housed there.
Trident spokesperson Joe Plesha in Seattle says the incident will definitely cut the season short in Chignik.
Obviously, the season won't last as long as it was intended because of the fire and the shutdown of the facility. But the season was on; it was winding down in any event.
Four people were treated at the local clinic for minor smoke inhalation. Two of them were later transported to King Salmon and then to Anchorage as a precautionary measure. All four have since been released. The plant is a total loss, Other buildings at the facility were not seriously damaged. There's no timetable on when the plant will be up and running again. A deputy fire marshal and an Alaska state trooper will be in Chignik today to investigate the cause of the fire. Trident officials will make the trip to make their own assessments as well. A damage estimate has not yet been determined. In Sandpoint, I'm Tony Gorman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, creek monitoring and cleanup in Wasilla.
We see a lot of trash. We see a lot of vehicles. We see, you know, fluids being dumped in there. But we're still seeing things like that today.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
In its first hearing on the bill that would provide $500 million to TransCanada to help with the development of a natural gas pipeline, the Senate Finance Committee today indicated the administration should not expect the money all at once. The Palin administration has requested the entire amount be appropriated this year, allowing reimbursement to TransCanada as needed. Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin said the money would cover quarterly reimbursements for expenses during the early stages of development.
We believe it's appropriate and that it's the good faith gesture on the part of the state to put that money aside at this time. We have the money available to us. We believe that it's appropriate to set it aside to recognize that we have this obligation under the license, and that at the time that we enter into the license is the appropriate point in time to put that aside and label it as dedicated to this venture.
Senators agree the total amount is part of the state's license that's up for a vote in the House today. But Senator Charlie Huggins called for what he calls a healthier technique that would be more appropriate to meet the state's obligation. He wants to pay the money in phases as it is requested. He said many of the people involved in the decision will change over the years, both from the administration and the legislature. Delayed appropriations would include them in the long-term process.
And it's an education process to set and talk about what happened here today a couple years from now at a minimum, so that people understand what we're funding, what AGIA is all about, and it's just to sort of refresh your course about where we're going and how we're spending the people's money.
The Finance Committee is not yet dealing with amendments, so no decision was made on the issue. Over the coming weeks, it will consider all four of the bills the governor proposed for the special session. Tomorrow, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing on the recent Supreme Court decision that reduced the award amount in the Exxon Valdez punitive damage case. The hearing is entitled Courting Big Business, the Supreme Court's Recent Decisions on Corporate Misconduct and Laws Regulating Corporations. Vermont Democrat Senator Patrick Leahy is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Leahy says revisions made by the high court that change fundamental aspects of lower court decisions have become too common.
They seem to be ignoring juries. They've become a very activist Supreme Court. They ignore what the juries have done. They instead impose their own views, even though they weren't there, even though they have to ignore the laws they work under. They've done this in Exxon Valdez. They've done it, of course, in things like the Ledbetter case of Lilly Ledbetter, where both cases, the jury found one way, the Supreme Court didn't hear the case, finds a different way. Here's a case where a jury found that Exxon Mobil knowingly, repeatedly allowed a relapsed alcoholic to operate a ship filled with oil through the Prince William Sound, destroyed the livelihood of thousands of Americans. And basically what the Supreme Court has said, okay, ExxonMobil, you don't have enough money. We're going to give you another $2 billion. And the jury had said they ought to pay actually less than 0.1% of their revenues to the victims. And now the victims have been told there's no way you can recover. You can't recover from something that was a horrible accident where the oil company was definitely at fault and where the Congress It made it very clear in the law the victims could recover.
And so what do you think's going on here? Do you think that there's corporate influence within the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that there has been an effort to make a more political Supreme Court in recent years. 7 of the 9 justices were appointed by Republicans. Certainly, President Bush made it very, very clear he wanted people who were going to rule a certain way. I feel you ought to have Supreme Court justices who look at each case on its merits and vote on the merits, not cast it in a political way. But that's what they've done. And for the life of me, I can't understand why the Supreme Court justices who have lifetime positions, who are paid very well, feel they have to follow the dictates of a Republican president.
Senator Leahy, what are you hoping to gain by having this hearing? What are you looking for?
Well, we're going to have a couple of different people testifying. I want to demonstrate what's happening. I think the American people will see a blip on the evening news and won't have a chance to really look into what happened. But this is happening in a lot of different kind of cases. And it's the American people being heard. I want to demonstrate one that we in Congress feel the courts have not followed the law. And if we need to pass new or change the laws that are there, we'll do that. But to do that, we have to have the hearings first to demonstrate both the need and the best way to go about the changes.
I've heard that some Alaskans are calling for censuring the Supreme Court justices. Is that a possibility?
No, and I'm not in favor of that, even on those decisions where I strongly disagree with them. But I think that we in the Congress can react by making some major changes to the law to make it clear that we disagree with the Supreme Court and hope they won't make this mistake again. But unfortunately, what they've done, they've given a windfall profit to ExxonMobil, and they've turned their back on people who can't afford the terrible loss they've suffered. My own state of Vermont, people are saying, how could any court treat the people of Alaska that badly?
And so why not censure?
Well, censure wouldn't pass. We'd spend our whole time on trying to get something like that, even if it was advisable. I'd rather spend my time on fixing the law so it doesn't happen again.
What do you think Congress can and should do in that regard as far as you said, fixing the law?
Well, make it very clear that we rely on jury judgments and not second-guessing by the Supreme Court. And make that very clear on the laws that everybody operates under.
Senator Leahy, in your mind, is there anything that can be done now that this decision has come from the Supreme Court? Can anything be done to help the plaintiffs?
Well, we'll raise that question at the hearing. But I think the Supreme Court has given a windfall to ExxonMobil and have really given dealt a very bad blow to the people of Alaska.
Senator Patrick Leahy will be holding a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing tomorrow to examine the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Exxon Valdez punitive damage case. Ossa Schultz traveled from Cordova to Washington to testify at tomorrow's hearing. Schultz and her husband have been commercial fishers in Cordova since 1980. She says they've been able to hang on, but many others have gone broke and had to give up on fishing. She says although she'd love to see Congress overturn the Supreme Court's decision, she thinks that's just too much to hope for.
Not impossible, but I'm not expecting it. But what I want is I want the Congress to realize that this is a serious state that we're in right now. And if we allow a corporation like Exxon to get away with something like this and pay so little for punitive damages that it doesn't even scratch them, and it's just their power is unstoppable if we do not enact legislation that sets up punitive damages that make a difference and deter them and make them be accountable.
Schultz says decisions on corporate misconduct oversight go beyond Alaskan fishermen and impact all Americans. Ongoing efforts to monitor Matanuska Valley water systems are being manned by volunteers who brave foul weather and mosquitoes to collect accurate data to help fight water pollution. A few years ago, many Wasilla residents noticed white foam on Cottonwood Creek, a stream that meanders through urban congestion. Their observations spurred an intensive quality assessment program aimed at finding the source of the foam. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Crank up here and we'll head on out if you'll untie us here, Doc.
Pat Sweeney and his wife Marie are off on a jaunt on their small but sturdy pleasure craft. But this is no pleasure cruise. They drop anchor in the middle of Seymour Lake near Wasilla and continue working as a light drizzle begins to fall on the slight bit of canvas covering the deck.
0.158.
Mm-hmm. Dissolved oxygen has dropped way off now, so low as 5.25. And 8.12.
The two are part of a group of volunteers who collect lake water samples to help provide accurate data to assist the Matanuska Valley Lake Management Program. Kathy Eagle, who coordinates sampling volunteers for the Matanuska Susitna Borough, and I are along for the ride as the Sweeney's boat bobs at anchor.
0.148.
This program kind of grew out of the fact that the borough population is growing so much. People started getting concerned that with the development around the lakes, the lake water quality would be diminished.
Volunteers collect data on water pH, clarity, temperature, electrical conductivity, and of course they take actual samples from a device called a...
the Van Doren water sampler.
It's lowered into the water, then hoisted back on board, where its contents are poured into holding jars. The monthly water samples are analyzed for bacteria. It's part of a State Department of Environmental Conservation plan to ensure that Alaska water bodies meet Environmental Protection Agency pollution standards. DEC's Laura Eldred says the program has two missions.
If those waters are meeting state water quality standards, and if they're not, so meaning that they are polluted in some way, then we have to figure out how to fix it.
Eldred says 13-mile-long Cottonwood Creek, which rises from a mountain spring and empties into Knik Arm, provides a good example of water quality investigation.
Cottonwood Creek is a really interesting stream that it's a neat system, kind of different for this area. It's a spring-fed system, and then it runs through a series of several lakes in its 13-mile run down to Knik Arm.
Cottonwood Creek also runs through some of the most heavily developed acreage in the valley.
Starting in the late 90s, there were different volunteer water quality monitoring groups that started collecting some water quality data on Cottonwood Creek. And about the same time, the state DEC, we started receiving increased amount of citizen concerns or complaints about the water quality of Cottonwood Creek, especially with increasing development happening in the area.
In 2002, the creek was listed as impaired under the Federal Clean Water Act. The action prioritized the creek for intensive water quality testing, which took place from 2004 through 2007. Complainants had pointed the finger at rampant mall development along the creek, but tests indicated something else.
What we're seeing is that foam is naturally occurring, but we think that human changes to the system may be changing the amount and timing of the foam. But it's through those studies of the foam that we started having questions about the temperature of Cottonwood Creek.
At first, Cottonwood Creek appeared to be warming.
The amount of temperature in a creek is really important, and Cottonwood Creek does have salmon that still run in it, so the temperature can create like a thermal barrier where they can't migrate through that because it's too warm, and it can also affect the amount of dissolved oxygen that's available for the fish to use in breathing.
Researchers followed the stream of water as it ran into and out of lakes on its way to Knik Arm.
And so through our sampling, what we really found, though, is that the increased temperatures tend to be below the different lakes in the system.
The warmth was actually coming from the lake water. When the stream crossed paths with the lake, its water temperature increased. Eldred says the stream's temperature normalized as it traveled away from the lake.
And the lakes have large surface areas that are open directly to the sun. This water warms up And then downstream, the water tends to cool the further it gets away from the lake. And so what we're finding is that if we're taking our temperature samples near the outlet of the lake, the water temperatures are higher. The further away we get from the lake, they're cooling off.
Eldred says warm air temperatures affect the lakes, and that temperature increase is passed on to the streams that feed them. She says Cottonwood Creek is among several being monitored by DEC in the valley. One way to help ensure water temperatures friendly to salmon is to keep lawn fertilizers and junk out of valley water systems.
You know, we see a lot of trash, we see a lot of vehicles, we see, you know, fluids being dumped in there, but we're still seeing things like that today.
She says buffer zones along creek sides allow vegetation to shade fish and keep waters cooler. A final report on the status of Cottonwood Creek is due out the end of this month. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Aleutian Islands volcanoes Akmak and Cleveland continue to be active. The community of Unalaska is about 65 miles northeast of Akmak, and Cleveland is 90 miles west of Akmak. Alaska Volcano Observatory geochemist Melissa Pfeffer says seismic activity at Akmak remains high.
It's episodic, so the high seismic activity is not consistent, but it comes and it goes, so we're keeping a close eye on it. The strong seismic peaks are coming at an interval about once every 15 minutes.
Pfeffer says Cleveland does not have seismic monitors.
But our most recent satellite images indicate thermal anomalies, which indicates that there could be lava flowing at Cleveland.
Pfeffer says the plume traveling away from Cleveland is mostly steam and ash. You can see webcams of the volcano's activity by following the link on our website, aprn.org. Governor Palin is expanding her offices in the Atwood Building in Anchorage. State Leasing and Facilities Manager Tansy Minns says the governor's staff are taking over enough space for 6 offices and 2 or 3 workstations. Palin spokeswoman Sharon Lehow says the new offices are for Palin's Juneau-based staffers, but it's not an example of state jobs creeping away from the Capitol.
Those offices will be used as traveling offices for her Juneau staff who travel back and forth. There are no plans to relocate any positions to Anchorage.
The governor currently has 22 staff in Juneau, including 3 at the governor's mansion. She has 16 in Anchorage, 3 in Fairbanks, and 6 in Washington, D.C. Health officials are keeping an eye on several cases of pertussis in southeast Alaska. The respiratory illness is also known as whooping cough. Symptoms range from a light cold to a severe spasmodic cough accompanied by fever and vomiting. Juneau pediatrician Marna Schwartz says she knows of 1 case in the capital city in the past week. She says there may be up to 2 others. That's enough to make her worry, since pertussis is very contagious.
It can be a real problem for very young or newborn babies, and also for the elderly. And older children, especially those with any kind of chronic medical conditions, can also be at risk for complications from pertussis, but healthy kids can too.
Schwartz treats children at Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital and the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium's clinic. She urges parents to watch for symptoms and seek medical care if needed. State epidemiologist Beth Funk confirmed 3 Southeast cases have been reported in the past month. Funk says any cases of pertussis need to be watched, but she says the current situation is not an epidemic. Pertussis is spread by sneezing and coughing and is treated with antibiotics. Funk and Schwartz strongly recommend vaccination to prevent its spread. Alaska Airlines plans to experiment with onboard broadband internet service starting next month. The carrier will charge for the wireless service, although rates have not been set. Passenger advocates say Wi-Fi will be welcomed with limits. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
A number of airlines have experimented with online onboard service. American Airlines, for example, is testing a wireless system this summer that has received positive reviews. Alaska Airlines announced its intent to offer the service last year and hoped to start trying it out by June. The deadline's been pushed back, but officials say Wi-Fi will be tested in the air starting in August. Vice President Steve Jarvis says the system will have a wide geographic range because it uses satellite connections.
A lot of other carriers are using air-to-ground, going to go with an air-to-ground solution, and when there's no tower on the ground, there'll be no connection. Ours is going to use the Hughes satellite system, so we really did it because we have so many customers in regions like Alaska that are going to need connectivity in areas where there is not a cell tower on the ground.
The Seattle-based airline is partnering with the California-based telecommunications company Row 44. That company is also working with Dallas-based Southwest Airlines. Row 44 president Greg Fialkowicz says onboard broadband service will be nothing unusual for laptop users.
What'll happen is it'll be very similar to going into a Wi-Fi-enabled hotel or a hotspot such as a coffee shop, where you'll open up your laptop. When you start up your browser, you'll be greeted by a login page that will be branded by the airline. It'll ask for your credit card information. You would give it the credit card information, and then you're free to surf the web.
He says the service will be tested on one Alaska Airlines jet starting in August. Installation on other planes will begin by the end of the year. Fleet-wide deployment will take another 12 months to complete. Other airline service fees have ranged from $6 to $13 per flight. Jarvis says Alaska Airlines will experiment with its rates, including those based on distance. Airplanes are one of the last refuges from Internet life. But David Stamey of the Dallas-based International Airline Passengers Association says people want Wi-Fi on board.
Our membership has come back very, very loudly and said virtually without equivocation that 7 out of 10 of them absolutely support having the ability for Wi-Fi on the airplane where you could do text messaging or do your email work, but absolutely no voice service. They've actually asked us for, tell us the carriers are going to have the voice service and we'll stay off of the airline.
Alaska Airlines says it will block online phone calls, such as those offered by Skype or Yahoo or cellular service. Federal agencies also prohibit cell phone use on airlines. Alaska Airlines says no other restrictions are planned, such as pornography filters, but officials say an aircraft's close cabin environment should encourage limits. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Weird reports tonight from John Ryan in Juneau, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Tony Gorman in Sandpoint. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.